Welcome to The Free Will Show, a podcast that provides a beginner-friendly introduction to free will while also exploring cutting-edge developments on the topic. I'm Taylor Sear.
And I'm Matt Flummer. In this episode, we talk with Amy Seymour about the Occamist solution to the problem of freedom and foreknowledge.
Thanks for listening. I'm happy to introduce Amy Seymour, who's assistant professor of philosophy at Fordham University. Amy works primarily on issues in metaphysics, specializing in the intersection of issues in time, free will, and philosophy of religion. She's written about epistemic and agential puzzles related to our and God's relationship to time, including metaphysical requirements for future free action, cross-time relations, and perhaps of particular interest today, the constraints our temporal theorizing will have on what's knowable, even for an omniscient being. She's also working on a book for the Cambridge Elements series on the problem of sin and suffering. And we're excited to have her on the podcast today, not only because she can help us to explore the Occamist view of freedom and foreknowledge in more detail than we've been able to on the podcast so far, but also because she'll introduce some ideas from her work on the metaphysics of time that will be relevant for this and other discussions this season on freedom and foreknowledge. So welcome to the show, Amy. Can you start by telling us a bit about yourself, your work, and how you came to be interested in working on free will?
Thank you so much for having me. So the most important fact about me right now is how delighted I am to be here. So thank you so much for having me. I think this is a great podcast, and it has quite a few of my own philosophical heroes on here. So it's a real treat. In terms of how I got interested in issues related to free will, I think like a lot of children, I think children are often quite philosophical in nature. So we think about when we're kids, a lot of philosophical questions, but not under that description. Like, what if this is just a really long nap and none of this has happened? What if everybody in me is a robot? These kinds of things. Yep. And I have a very distinct memory being about 4 years old and playing with little play school people in a play school dollhouse. And I was raised in a religious household. I am religious. And I remember thinking to myself, what if God is just moving us around? Like, I'm moving around these play school dollhouse people. Like that's the sort of thing that's happening. Not realizing at the time that this is a big issue in free will, these kinds of questions I've always been... as long as I can remember, right, been thinking about these kinds of issues. And so once you start getting older, I think a lot of us don't think about these philosophical issues as much, or at least under that description. I was still the kid, you know, in English class when they ask, would Macbeth have tried to become king if he hadn't had the prophecy? I was getting real into it in a way. People who don't work on freedom and foreknowledge don't. But it wasn't until I started taking philosophy classes in college that I got particularly interested in these issues again and realized, hey, a really cool thing is you could actually be a professional philosopher. This had not occurred to me at all until I was really enjoying my philosophy classes. It became time to choose a major, and I thought, okay, great, I can keep on doing this. And while I was taking a philosophy of religion class with David Vanderlaan out at Westmont College, we were going through a lot of the kinds of issues we'll be talking about today with Nelson Pike and Alvin Plantinga and Peter Van Inwagen. And I was so fascinated by this. And I thought, I want to be able to talk with these guys. I want to be able to learn from people like this. And I recognized you could go to grad school. You could do this for a living. It had never occurred to me before that this was an actual option. So I was lucky enough to be able to do exactly those things. And on my way, I was able to have the absolute delight of working with Alicia Finch at Northern Illinois University, taking metaphysics and free will classes from her, and then getting to go to Notre Dame and taking metaphysics classes with Peter Van Inwagen and Michael Ray, and having really great discussions with them as well. So listeners might hear, since Alicia and Peter have been on the show before, they might hear similar strains coming from me, as you know, from my philosophical lineage. And I've been with philosophers who are gracious enough to let me disagree with them as well as with them as well. So while I'm from that philosophical family, there are quite a few places where I'm sure both Alicia and Peter and Mike and all of them have held their head in their hands and said, oh no, philosophical way. So I think that's sort of the long and short of a lot of my interest here.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Well, longtime listeners of this podcast will have heard the name Occamism several times, both in connection with logical fatalism and in connection with divine foreknowledge. The view gets its name from William of Ockham, an early 14th century philosopher and theologian who argued that divine foreknowledge is not incompatible with human free will. Could you give a brief summary of the Occamist's response to the problem of freedom and foreknowledge?
Absolutely. So one important thing I want to note off the bat is that I am a contemporary metaphysician and not a historian of philosophy. So while I'll have some expertise discussing the view labeled Occamism, I won't be able to speak to whether or not our use of Occam's name is going to be historically accurate. The contemporary debate really gets started thanks to a paper in 1965 by Nelson Pike titled Divine Omniscience and Voluntary Action. And that's where I'm going to start as well. Before I'll get into the nitty-gritty of the view and how it responds to some classic fatalist arguments, I think it's important to give and motivate a really important distinction that the Occamist uses. So the Occamist thinks that there is an important distinction between types of facts. So there are different kinds of facts about particular times. And spoiler alert, this distinction will give us a reason to reject certain transfer of necessity principles that come up in classic fatalist arguments. I'll give those details in a bit, but for now, longtime listeners will be well-versed in these fatalist puzzles. So now you know where we're going. And so I'll motivate this kind of distinction. So here it is. Occamists want to start somewhere really deeply intuitive, and that's that not all facts are created equal. They think that there are some facts that are about particular times, and there are other facts that, you know, while they're true at a particular time, they're not really about that time. They're not especially about that time in the right sort of way. I'll talk more about this distinction. This is a distinction between hard facts, those facts about a time, and soft facts that are relational in important respects and not about that time. The distinction is a bit tricky because there's not deep-seated consensus about how it goes, the particulars that are required for it. But it's similar to another distinction that metaphysicians are typically quite comfortable with when they think about individuals, objects, and events and the properties that they have. So I'll talk for a little bit about what are called intrinsic properties and then relate those intrinsic properties analogously to this hard and soft fact distinction. So for this part of the podcast, I'll need a volunteer. Matt, are you okay being used?
Sure.
Okay, so we won't reduce down Matt's ontological status to just being an object, but it's helpful for our particular purposes.
I appreciate that, yeah.
Perfect. So let's think about the properties that Matt has. There are a lot of properties that he has. Some of these properties are specifically about him, in and of himself. So these are properties like his height at this particular time, the particular shape that he has. So David Lewis would describe him as being shaped in a bent way since he's currently sitting. These are facts that are about Matt in and of himself. So we were, you know, if we wanted to label all the things that are only supposed to be about him. But Matt has a whole lot of other properties aside from just these particular individual properties that are intrinsic to him, just about himself. One that I'm particularly interested in right now is that Matt has the property of being a podcast host with Taylor. He's got this relational property. And that particular property that Matt has is not just about Matt. It involves Taylor. It involves Taylor. It involves their podcast. It involves a whole lot of other things besides. And because it's involving these kinds of things that point outside or point beyond Matt, these are called extrinsic properties. These are things that are outside of just things that are concerned with Matt. So that's the general distinction that seems pretty intuitive for a lot of the metaphysical literature in terms of properties. The hard soft fact distinction that the Occamist wants to use is analogous to this kind of distinction here. So take these sort of aboutness ideas for intrinsic properties and apply those to hard facts. A hard fact is supposed to be a fact that is just about that particular time in question. So pick a particular time now for the podcast. It'll be hard to isolate down, but we're philosophers. We can select an arbitrary one. So we'll take our temporal snapshot and we say, okay, there are particular facts about this time, where all of us are seated, what we're doing, what we're talking about at this particular time. These are all facts that are hard facts. They're about the particular time in question. But those aren't the only facts that are true now at this particular time. There are other facts that make reference to other times. They point beyond the particular time in question. So beliefs about other times are great examples of these kinds of facts which point beyond the time that we have now. So here's a fact, is that it's true now that I believe I will have dinner with friends later. So this is something that's pointing beyond the particular time right now. It involves a future time. It involves things that are not going on right now. So those kinds of facts, these ones that point beyond, are analogous to these extrinsic properties. These are the soft facts. These are the things that are not to do just with the particular time in question. So the Occamist uses this sort of distinction to try to answer problems in terms of fatalism. They use this particular distinction because they say, you know, this is our spoiler alert for where we're going. They say that the particular wrong move that's made in the argument is having to say that you're locked in because something's true now about another time, then what happens at that later time is something that you have no control about. And the Occamist throws up their hands here and they say, whoa, you're ignoring this really important distinction about hard and soft facts. The hard facts presumably are the things that we can't do anything about, you know, say if they're in the past. But the soft facts are these kinds of things that should be under our control. Why? Intuitively, because they involve other agents or they involve other times. So why on earth should everything about them be locked in an inappropriate way earlier on? So let's think about this, this distinction in terms of a logical or theologically fatalist puzzle here. And since, you know, I won't be the first guest who has wished for a whiteboard. This is the joy and the pain of a podcast is not being able to put up, you know, thoroughly technical things. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give a very intuitive gloss of the argument first, and then I'll take us through the deeper nitty gritty of the arguments. And I've particularly picked, there's a lot of different versions of this argument. I've picked one I'm hopeful is easier to follow, but this will apply for more formalized versions of the argument as well.
Yeah, good.
So here, I don't want to reinvent the wheel. I want to quote directly from Alicia Finch when she talks about logical and theological fatalism, just to give us, as she puts it, the pith of the argument for logical fatalism. So she says, every proposition is either true or false. Suppose that the proposition is true. If this proposition is ever true, it's always true. And if this proposition is always true, there is never a time in which it is up to S whether it's true or false. Indeed, if this proposition is always true, it is true long before S comes into existence, and hence long before S is able to do anything at all. But if there's never a time in which it is up to S whether it is true or false, S does not freely perform A at T. Since this point generalizes to any agent, any act in any time, free action is going to be impossible. So that's the sort of standard gloss for a standard logically fatalist argument. Divine foreknowledge puzzles crank up the problem a little bit more because they're introducing an agent which is infallible. So this is going to take a view of God where God is going to count as a perfect being. And some of the properties of this perfect being are going to include things like omniscience and omnipotence. So you're going to, you know, you'll know everything that it's possible to know. You'll have all the power that it's possible to have, these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And an agent with omniscience is really going to either generate or heighten the problem, depending on what view you have about types of fatalist puzzles. So think about what omniscience requires. So omniscience, difficult also to define this one, but here's an intuitive gloss. It's knowing everything that can be known. And so what can be known? Here's a common assumption. And this is a common assumption that, spoiler alert, some of us, including me, will ultimately disagree with. But here's the common assumption. And it seems really intuitive at first. What has taken place, what is taking place, and what will take place are all things that can be known. That's the assumption. And so this is the assumption that's actually in the background in the contemporary debate about Occamism as it restarts in the 1960s. And it's kept on going, but between the 60s and the 80s particularly, there's a lot of back and forth about this particular argument. In the back and forth about this particular argument, this was the common assumption in play. So think about various facts. Say if it's true now that Sally goes to the store in 2050, then Sally goes to the store in 2050. So Sally's going to the store is a logical consequence of that statement's truth. If Sally's going to be free with respect to going to the store in 2050, it somehow must be up to her to make it so that the proposition could be false. This rendering false idea that we've had before on the podcast here. So Nelson Pike, who's bringing this problem again to the fore in 1965, is aiming to show that if there's an omniscient divine being, no human could have this power. So if Pike is right, the theist is caught between a rock and a hard place. They either need to drop their theistic view that they presumably want, that God knows everything that can be known, or they've got to drop a view that they have about the ability for any agent to be free. They've got to drop at least one of those two, at least according to this version of the fatalist puzzle. So let's think about a more formal version of the argument now. And I'll have this for us in five premises. So premise one, God knows in advance, we'll label this time T1, that we will have this podcast interview at, say, T2. And the reasons here for this premise are that this omniscience assumption that I just talked about, coupled with this future truth assumption, that if something in the future is true, it's always been true. So those things are generating that first premise. Now we've got our second premise. If God knows at T1 that we will have this podcast interview at T2, then it must be the case that we'll have this podcast interview at T2. The reason behind this one is that knowledge is factive. That is, knowledge requires truth. You can't know something that's false. From here, we move to premise three. If it must be the case that we will have this podcast interview at T2, then it isn't possible for us to refrain from now having this podcast interview at T2. And the reasoning behind this is a sort of transfer of necessity principles. We have no power over what must be the case. And if it already must be, it's going to push through any sort of conditional here. Mm-hmm. Now we get to our fourth premise. If it isn't possible for us to refrain from having this podcast interview at T2, then we aren't free with respect to having this podcast interview at T2. So this is just supposed to be the definition of free will here. Then we get to our conclusion coming from all four premises. Therefore, we aren't free with respect to having this podcast interview at T2. And this argument is going to metastasize to all human action. It's going to metastasize to any agent. It might even metastasize to a divine agent. You know, if God knows now what God's going to do 100 years from now, you can even get problems with divine action going here too. So it's not even just a creaturely freedom problem, at least as stated. And a lot of times people heighten these sorts of examples and cases by thinking about, you know, it being true 1,000 years ago that we would have this podcast interview now. If we've got that assumption that if something's true, it's always been true, you know, go as far back as you want to really raise the stakes of this problem before, you know, Matt and Taylor and I even exist. You know, at the moment after the Big Bang, God's going to know we're going to have this podcast interview on in 2022. So that's the general problem. Well, hopefully with this argument in play now, we can see the crucial move in this argument from Pike. And this is exactly what people like Alvin Plantinga capitalize on by utilizing this Occamist response. Plantinga thinks Pike makes a mistake when evaluating the must in premises 2 and 3. So there are weak and strong readings here. So as a reminder, those key premises are, if God knows at T1 that we'll have a podcast interview at T2, then it must be the case that we'll have this interview at T2. Then moving to that next premise, if it must be the case that we'll have a podcast interview at T2, then it's not possible for us to refrain from having a podcast interview at T2. So that must there, the Occamist is going to pounce on it and say, well, wait a minute. The must that's happening there is all mixed up. Pike and people who want to push fatalist problems here are reading that must as like logical necessitation. And then we transfer that lack of freedom through and then get into huge problems. But that's going to require a really strong reading that God's knowing really doesn't earn at this point. You're going to have to put a lot more into the argument to motivate something like a really stronger reading. So here are two readings of those kinds of musts. Here's the first one, and it's a weaker one. Necessarily, if God knows in advance that X will do A, then it must be the case that X will do A. Now, this by itself is not a problem. A is something that everyone should accept, since it's an instance of the following fact. Necessarily, if somebody knows why, Y is true. So this is just an application of knowledge. Knowledge is factive, no problem. So this is just putting an omniscient being in there instead of just, you know, sadly, one of us who's not. Now, here's a strong reading of must there in terms of knowing. If it is necessary that X will do A, then X is not free to refrain from A. So that strong reading also looks good, especially in light of these classic fatalist puzzles. So if an action of yours is necessary, you're not free to do otherwise than you do. Now, here's the key question. Does the definitional fact that weak reading A, lead to this strong reading of necessity of action, that second definition? Does the definitional fact of knowing lead to the necessity of action? Pike thinks it does. And so this is what kicked off the whole debate. So Pike thinks that if God knows in advance that X will do A, then it is necessary that X will do A. And then the consequent gives us that strong reading there that gets logical fatalism to follow. But there's a problem here. So I want us to consider a parity argument of this sort of case. So let's think about something like this. Weak reading. Necessarily, if God knows that Henry is a bachelor, then Henry must be unmarried. Now, this doesn't look like a problem at all. This follows from the definition of bachelor. This does not lead to a stronger reading, which is, if God knows that Henry is a bachelor, then Henry is necessarily unmarried. Mm-hmm. Why does this one not follow? Well, while Henry's a bachelor in this world, we'll label it Alpha, there are other possible worlds in which Henry is not a bachelor. Henry found love. Hooray. So Henry's currently being unmarried does not mean that Henry is necessarily a bachelor or a bachelor in all possible worlds. And this latter understanding is the idea of must or necessitation that would lead to his not being able to do otherwise. So it's a lot of moving pieces, I know, or it's going to come all together right now. Fingers crossed. So now we're back to the argument. So Pike and other proponents of this argument for theological fatalism think that if their necessitation premise were false, then God is not necessarily or essentially omniscient. There'd be at least, you know, God could be wrong. There'd be at least one possible world in which God wouldn't know something about you. But that doesn't necessarily follow. And here's where the Occamist says, well, look, things that have to be settled, things that have to be locked in are these hard facts? It would be really bad if there were a fact about what's going on at a particular time right now that God just didn't know. Like, then we'd think, okay, there's a being which isn't omniscient. But we have these facts that point beyond the original time in question. The Occamists thinks that we're not locked in the way that we might have thought. So think about our having a podcast interview right now at T2. Suppose we didn't. It'd be a worse world for me. I'd be bummed out. But suppose that this didn't happen. It doesn't follow that God would be wrong in those other worlds. Rather, what God would know is itself different. God would know something different than what actually happens. Why would God know something different? Well, I would be doing something different. I would be doing something different at this particular time. So these soft facts, and here I'll make a particular claim on behalf of Occamists that is contentious, these are facts that depend crucially on other times. We have this dependence relation with soft facts that we don't have with hard facts. So these kinds of things that would make us think that we're locked in fatalistically to what God knows or predicts, don't worry, it's not the case. You know, it's within our power right now to have done something that if we did it, then a belief that God had earlier at T1 would have been false. So it's within our power right now that soft facts way back when were different. So this doesn't mean that God would have a false belief. Instead, we would have brought it about that God did not hold the belief that God actually did at T1. So these soft facts are facts that we have power over in a way that we don't have power over these hard facts. So think about the moment after the Big Bang. The Occamist says, well, these, you know, hard facts are going to be things like the particular location of various atoms that are, you know, had back there. You know, we don't have any power over that. And presumably, here's where it gets a little dicey, we also don't have power over the fact that God has beliefs. But we do have power over the content of God's beliefs, because those are these soft facts. These are things that point beyond actually things about God, things about that particular time. These kinds of fatalist arguments run, and particularly theological ones, by saying, well, hang on, if the past is fixed or settled, you know, there's no use crying over spilled milk, it's there and done. Back in the past, God had beliefs about what we would do now. And not just beliefs, God's omniscient, so God had knowledge about what we would be doing right now. And since the past is fixed, again, we've got that transfer of necessity to the present. You know, if the past is fixed and what's happened in the past is accidentally necessary, we can't do anything about it now. What's happening now is something that we can't do anything about. The Occamist swoops in to try to save the day and they say, no. The principle of the fixity of the past is actually the principle of the fixity of the hard past. Mm-hmm. So Finch defines the principle of the fixity of the hard past as necessarily for any agent S, any proposition P, and any time T. If P describes a state of affairs O that is a hard fact at T, it is not up to S at or after T whether P is true. The Occamist thinks, yeah, the principle of the fixity of the past is just simply the principle of fixity of the hard past. Mm-hmm. But the principle of fixity of the soft past, you know, we can't explode and say that things that are soft facts are also fixed or settled. Why do we not want to do that? Well, for the same reason that we don't want to say that we have no control over certain kinds of extrinsic or relational facts. So let's head back to the example that we started off with at the beginning. So there are certain facts about Matt right now that are not up to Taylor. You know, the fact that, you know, there are things that he could do now to try to convince, you know, Matt to stand up. He could say, hey, could you go get me a drink of water or something like this? Matt's a nice guy. He'd say, of course, he'd stand up. But he's, you know, Matt's bent right now. That's about him. But there are various relational kinds of facts, these extrinsic facts, that looks like they are up to Taylor in certain kinds of ways. Not the sum total, but part of them are up to Taylor in a certain way. we know this won't happen, but, you know, it could be, you know, Taylor stands up and says, I'm through with this podcast and stomps off right now. You know, changing the extrinsic property that Matt has of co-hosting a podcast with Taylor. So thankfully, we're not in this sort of world. But presumably, Taylor does have that sort of power. And so that kind of power, the Occamist thinks, carries over into these kinds of debates in terms of free will. We don't have any say over these hard facts about the past. You know, the Big Bang happened. Nothing we can do about that now, which is probably a good thing. These facts about what God believes we will do now and later, those are things that are up to us. And if we had decided to do something different, God would have believed something entirely different the entire time. So that's the, I was going to say the long and short of it, but probably the long of it.
That was great, though. I like especially the way you reviewed the kind of the Pike style argument for incompatibilism here. That was helpful. If I could ask a follow-up question about soft facts, as you mentioned, right, the Occamist really relies on that distinction, but it's also kind of hard to see what it is for something to be a soft fact. You characterized it in terms of this kind of extrinsicness, but I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about that or other potential criteria, and whether ultimately those are going to be satisfying.
Good. I think this is exactly the question to ask. And it's a question that honestly I have struggled with quite a bit, because this softness, I think it's an intuitive kind of distinction, but I found it quite difficult to be able to give something much more formalized that would be able to give the Occamist exactly what she wants here. So here I should actually admit to everyone, surprise, I'm a Trojan horse of a guest in presenting the Occamist view. But I don't actually think that it works. So this is, you have to beware of philosophers bearing gifts in terms of to soften the blow a little bit. This is the kind of distinction that I spent some time really trying to figure out if I thought it was workable, because it was very important to me as a theist that God know everything that can be known. And it was also very important to me theologically that humans have free will. And so I thought, okay, well, look, if God's going to be doing any sort of, you know, reward or judgment or anything like this, it seems like it should be up to me in certain kind of relevant respects. But if it's something that's equivalent to God moving us around in the dollhouse, or even if it's not that, if it's just God knowing where we're going to move around in the dollhouse way before it happens, that looks like a problem. So this is one of the things that I had gone through to try to see, is there any sort of theological way out here? To try to motivate the view a little bit more, I think the way to think about this, and here's where we start getting very contentious, and I will disagree a little bit with one of your previous guests. Also, there was a wonderful interview with Andrew Law where he was saying, you know, it's not, you know, Occamism isn't the same as just a dependent solution. And I will say, I think he's right. The mechanics of the Occamist view are not the same as the mechanics of the dependence view. I suspect if we want a really good, workable view of soft facts, it's going to be defined in terms of some kind of ontological dependence that I suspect may collapse ultimately into a dependence view. Mm-hmm. I think that these soft facts presumably are the kinds of things that depend on other sorts of times. That's the reason that you're not supposed to get locked in terms of them. So if it was true 100 years ago that we were having the podcast now, the way to take the fatalist edge off of things is to make sure, well, stronger than the fatalist edge, the way to block fatalism here is to make sure that the truth of our having this podcast interview now was due to us and our choices or something within our agent causal power. Or I'll put a gloss for event causal people here. You know, fill in the blank as it needs to be filled in here. But something about us and relevant agential power applies here. And so it's going to depend on us rather than depending on the past. And so one of the tricky bits of this is that this is not a view that's meant to be simply in terms of, say, backward causation. And a backward causation response is going to be particularly tricky for this kind of view, just because it being true in the past with God's knowing is meant to push us into this forward-looking only sort of situation. It's going to be true way back then. That's going to lock us in, or supposed to lock us into exactly what's happening now. And so the million-dollar question for the Occamist is, what is this kind of dependence relation that gives you the softness of the soft facts? Because presumably you can get these cases where truths point beyond the particular time in question. But what is it that's doing the pointing beyond? We can try to motivate this kind of view in terms of other things that we think aren't necessarily made true at a time or accounted for the truth at a time. So think about mathematical facts. You know, it's always going to be the case that 2 + 2 is identical to 4. That's not, you know, when we talk about this truth, we in some sense point beyond the present time or the time in question. But those particular facts are necessary. Those particular kinds of facts, mathematical facts, are necessary. Crud. Soft facts. I mean, like, if we say that the soft facts are necessary, oh no, we're right back into exactly where the fatalist wants us, as they say, yay, yes, I told you that. I think the fatalist is wrong. And I do think that these kinds of things that are labeled soft facts are different. And then so the million-dollar question is how they're different. The Occamist thinks that not all dependence relations are made equal. So if we're going to point beyond the particular time in question with these soft facts that involve things that we ourselves have control over, we've got to point beyond to something that we do have control over, whether that is a future time or whether that is, say, a counterfactual of creaturely freedom. The Molinist, this is another theological view, wants to say that, you know, there's something about your essence, where God can take a look at that and know what you would do in certain situations. Maybe that's the kind of thing that could make it true that you're doing what you do now. All right, you know, going back to the answer in terms of a time, you know, if all times exist ontologically equal to the way that the present one does now, if all past, present, and future objects just exist, well, 100 years ago, it was true that we're having the podcast now because, you know, if we had our temporal telescope, we could take a look and say, oh, hey, look, there they are actually having that particular podcast interview right out there somewhere. So in these particular kinds of cases, I think that there are resources that the Occamist has to explain or try to start explaining what it is that they mean by soft facts. But when we use these kinds of resources, I think it's important to note that Occamism, then, we want to think about it in terms of our ultimate cash value. You know, what are we getting for what we're paying for the view? And I think that the Occamist will tell us something important about further kinds of distinctions or commitments that we need to make. But my opinionated take is that the debate doesn't stop just with the Occamist position. The Occamist position is a first move that will tell you if you like the Occamist picture, if you like that kind of motivation, what kinds of answers you need to continue to give.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
We've already talked about the fixity of the past needs to be refined. It's not just the fixity of the past, it's the fixity of the hard past. Yes. One might wonder, though, about whether certain parts of the hard past are really going to end up being fixed on this view. For example, in a paper called On Occam's Way Out, Alvin Plantinga imagined a case in which God wants for a certain colony of carpenter ants to survive in Paul's yard, which would not happen if Paul mows his yard on Saturday. Since God knows in advance that Paul will not mow, he allows the ants to move into Paul's yard. But if God had foreknown instead that Paul would mow, then he would have prevented the ants from moving in. So now it seems that if Paul is free to mow on Saturday, he not only has power over God's beliefs, but he also has power over whether the ants moved into his yard earlier that week. What do you make of this kind of case? Do you think it's going to end up being a problem for Occamists?
Yeah, the case is a really interesting one. And I think the case shows us that not all dependence relations are made equal. So I think that this is, it grows less perplexing as a case if we think about a distinction between things that I have direct and indirect control over. So this case sounds, I think, really menacing. If we think about this in terms of my direct control, like it sounds odd to say that I would have direct control about whether or not the ants move into, sorry, whether Paul has any choice about whether or not the ants move into his yard. He doesn't have this direct control, but he does have indirect control. And indirect control is the sort of thing I think we typically tend to be more comfortable with. So there are lots of things that I can do now that have indirect control over various other things that happen. Whether or not I mail a check today has some direct or indirect, sorry, has some indirect control on what people in my apartment's management office do, you know, these kinds of cases. And that doesn't seem to be particularly concerning, or at least I find that less concerning than the ordinary kind of case. Or think about it in terms of knowledge. If I just simply watch how somebody votes, you'll have indirect control over what I believe about how you voted. Say we vote by show of hands. If I watch you raise your hand to vote for a particular candidate, you've got indirect control over my beliefs. And then I can, once I have that knowledge, choose to act in various kinds of ways. So I think while it might seem initially concerning, once we apply this kind of distinction, I think it starts to look less menacing. Now, I think, again, it is the case that the billion-dollar question is, well, how do I have this kind of indirect control or whether or not the ants are there? And I think the answer we need to give is in terms of either what times exist and, you know, what people are doing at various times, or in terms of some sort of counterfactuals of creaturely freedom or these sorts of things. There are people who try to raise the stakes of the problem. Some people think that since God, as an infallible knower, sees these sorts of things, again, you're going to get locked in a particular sort of way.
Yeah. Well, you just mentioned some, it might matter what times exist. So my next question is about that. So, a different sort of challenge for the Occamist is about the metaphysics of time, in particular the ontology of time, which times exist. And in particular, Alicia Finch and Michael Ray have argued that Occamism is incompatible with presentism, which is the view that only the present exists. Could you say a little bit about what presentism is and why there's a worry about reconciling it with Occamism?
Absolutely. So presentism is the view that there are no non-present objects or events. So the only objects that or events that exist are present objects. So if you think that truths have to be accounted for or supervene on being or what exists, you can only look to the present time for that. There's nothing outside of the present. Some people go even stronger and define presentism in terms of necessarily there are no non-present objects or events. So if you've got this view in play, the Occamist distinction looks really hard to use. And the reason why is that when we look, say, 1,000 years ago, God has some beliefs. These beliefs are not only true, they're knowledge and they're infallible knowledge. So God infallibly knows that we're having a podcast interview today. We're not out there somewhere having this podcast interview. None of us exist yet. Presumably, here comes back the problem in full force. There's nothing about ourselves or our agent causal power that can account for or make true God's belief that we're having a podcast interview right now. There's nothing about us that can do it. So the grounds for the truth or what accounts for the truth looks like it's something outside of us. Uh-oh, once it's outside of us, whatever it is in terms of God's belief, some other kinds of modal facts, they're all things that we don't have agential control over. Here, the logical fatalist and the theological fatalist will want to declare victory again. They'll say, this is exactly what we've been telling you. It's a logical fact that you can't do other than you do. Check out this logical bit of knowledge that God has here. And then you're off to the races again. So this sort of, I hesitate to call it standard way out of fatalist arguments, but I consider it standard just in terms of my own philosophical training. Peter Vandenwagen has a really great general answer to fatalist puzzles in chapter 2 of An Essay on Free Will. He talks about his decision to shave, and he says, well, what's accounting for the truth of him shaving is that he's out there shaving at that particular time. Now, I don't want to put words in Peter's mouth, since there's, you know, some temporal ontology that he's probably not going to endorse here. But one way in which, you know, Finch and Ray point out that you could make true or account for the truth of these kinds of statements is by this eternalist view. If all objects and events at all times exist, you know, this hard soft fact distinction can be utilized to say, well, hey, look, these soft facts point beyond to just what's happening in the decisions of agents at other times. And that's going to be what's accounting for and making true that kind of view. Mm-hmm. Now, Finch and Ray point out that if you make this kind of answer, if you say, well, I want Occamism and I want eternalism, Occamism's not on its own giving you anything special. Eternalism's really giving you everything that you need. Occamism just gives you some nice machinery to understand what's happening with the particular view in question. Finch and Ray think, though, as you pointed out, the presentist is in trouble because she doesn't have the ability to point to other times. They make a case that the kind of Molinist answer that I gestured towards doesn't work because they say, well, look, let's take a look at something that could make it true, say like an essence. Well, an essence isn't identical to you. You know, an essence is, you know, some sort of hexaity or group of set or class or group of properties that's going to say things about what would happen if these properties were exemplified. Mm-hmm. But that's not equivalent to you being exemplified and making certain kinds of decisions. So Finch and Ray think that if we make this kind of answer, either we've got something that's ungrounded, which that looks bad, since we want our choices to be grounded in ourselves or our individual agent causal. No, well, actually, they don't use agent causal terms. Let me back up. They want our decisions to be grounded in ourselves or something to do with our agential causal power. That's not available if it's a brute fact. But if the grounds are something like our essences, well, presumably my essence isn't something under my control either. So they think that if you don't have a view in which there actually are future objects and events that account for the truth of these kinds of statements about what God knows, presentism is one of those views, they think that you're out of luck then. The Occamist's way out is not available to you. By and large, I agree with Finch and Ray. I agree with them by and large. I've got a slight hesitancy about agreeing with him in terms of just blocking off counterfactuals of creaturely freedom. And the reason why is that I don't think counterfactuals of creaturely freedom work either. That's another thing that I said, oh, I wanted that to work, but I don't think that those work either. But if you are somebody who thinks that, genuine truths about you and your agent causal power can be accounted for by modal space in particular ways, then you might be able to utilize something about Occam's way out. You can say, well, what grounds the truth, you know, before you existed about us having a podcast now? It's partially grounded in, you know, at least three different individual essences and counterfactuals about what we would do, you know, depending on what circumstances we're put into. God, you know, sees that we're put into various circumstances. Therefore, God knows, I look at the counterfactuals of creaturely freedom. I have this what's called middle knowledge, where I can just see that they're having a podcast now. So it's a way to actually, this kind of move tries to take the temporal telescope view that the eternalist has and apply it to a sort of modal telescope view, where you could look at all the possible ways things could be. And I see that they are having this podcast interview, kind of any way you slice it, given the way that circumstances are set up. Finch and Ray are concerned about this kind of move because they think it grounds it in the wrong place. I'm inclined to agree with them. And in fact, I take that to be a little bit of weight. In fact, Michael Ray and I hardly ever agree on anything philosophical. if you do agree on something, it's probably right. for the listeners, this passes the Ray Seymour agreement test.
That's great.
Yeah. Well, here's a follow-up question. Speaking of Michael Ray, he's argued that presentists must either reject libertarianism about free will or must accept that the future is open in a way that requires denying the principle of bivalence, which says that all propositions have one of two truth values. You've responded to this worry on behalf of the presentist by suggesting that propositions about the contingent, undetermined future are all false. Could you explain that response and what do you think it has going for it?
Absolutely. Yes. And I should say, your listeners probably aren't looking for a pro tip for philosophical advisors, but if they are, look for somebody who's okay with you disagreeing with them vehemently. Earlier on, I talked about how one of the assumptions motivating these kinds of fatalist puzzles is the assumption that if something is true, it's always been true. So if it's true now that we're having this podcast interview, it's always been true, you know, at every other time that we're having this kind of podcast interview. So there is this kind of assumption, which on an eternalist view makes sense. You know, there's just all these other times, you know, we've got soft facts that can look at other times other than this one. We say, lo and behold, they're all true. Nobody's locked in. But I personally don't see any reason why the presentist should want to endorse that. I think the presentist should just get off the train basically before it leaves the station. So the general kind of assumption is that, you know, if presentism is true, then it's going to still be the case that, say, it was true 100 years ago that we're having this podcast interview right now. Why should we think it's true 100 years ago? Well, we're having it right now. So why not think it's true? And so a sort of standard way out of this problem is to say, well, it wasn't true until it became true. You know, it wasn't true until we ourselves started having this podcast interview and the relevant kinds of decisions were made. One answer you could give is then to deny bivalence, to say, well, this just had a question mark. You know, our having this podcast interview now just simply lacked a truth value until we had it. Mm-hmm. I think we should just say it's false if you take a view of propositions that says, well, the lack of truth is just falsity, then this kind of view starts to look motivated. So Bertrand Russell very famously approached propositions this way. So if we say, you know, true or false, the present king of France is bald, you might be inclined to give one of two answers. One might be just be like, you know, question mark. That's the bivalence denial response.
Right.
The kind of response that I want to give, and this is a response that's been given by Arthur Pryor, Charles Sanders Peirce, Charles Hartshorne, Alan Rota, Ned Markosian, and others. So this kind of response that I want to give just says, well, let's say that falsity is simply a lack of truth. True or false, the present king of France is bald. False. There's no present king of France. So anytime there's presupposition failure, you give back a false. And the false is reality just doesn't look like that. Like, no, that's not what it is. Thumbs down. Similarly, with anything that's about the future, if it's not presently necessitated, that is, if it's what's called a future contingent, something that doesn't have to be the case, that's still metaphysically unsettled, still up to us or other agents, or maybe even just indeterministic processes or something like this, there's not going to be a truth about it. But since there's not a truth about it, there's presupposition failure. And then just thumbs down, we get a false back for these kinds of things. Now, for a long time, people thought that this kind of view was simply a non-starter. And the reason why is they thought, well, this is just going to either give you logical contradiction problems now, or it'll give you contradictory problems later. So let's think about this. Now, it's, you know, say it's false that I will have dinner with my friends tonight. Why? Well, there's not a single selected future that, you know, shows me having dinner with my friends right now. There's no temporal telescope we can look at. It's not determined by the present facts and state of the world right now. So it's up in the air. So we'll say it's false that I will go to have dinner with my friends tonight. But on the other hand, wait a minute. It's also false that I won't have dinner with my friends tonight. You know, the will not also looks false. Why? The will not would show just, you know, a temporal telescope and me not having dinner with my friends. There, you know, there's just an absence. They all meet. I'm not there. Or, you know, lots of other ways this could be made true. But I want to say, well, no, if the future's really open with respect to my having dinner with my friends tonight, there are some futures in which I do. There are some futures in which I don't. The way that the person with this particular view, I call us the all falsists. We say all contingent propositions are false. Mm-hmm. The way that the all falsist makes sense of this is we say, well, this kind of will, when we refer to the future, these future facts here, it's like a modal. It's like necessity and possibility. It's kind of like that. So take an analogous case. In grad school, we used to have a cat that was, she had a very hard life. She was a feral kitten. And so she was very mean and ill-tempered. You know, you'd pet her, she'd just haul off and bite you sometimes. Poor little Soda. We love Soda. poor little Soda. It's false that she was necessarily ill-tempered. You know, she had this characteristic, she was ill-tempered, but she wasn't necessarily ill-tempered. There are other possible worlds in which, you know, she had a very good kittenhood and was like the sweetest animal that's ever lived. It's also demonstrably false that she necessarily wasn't ill-tempered. Why? You know, look back, you know, 10 years ago, she's actively biting people. You know, there she is. What's true is actually something else. The negation is on the outside of what are called these modal operators of will, or necessary and possible here. So the truth in the neighborhood here is it's not the case that Soda was necessarily ill-tempered. You know, it's not the case. You know, why? Well, she could have had a nice kittenhood. So when these kinds of what are called modal operators, like necessity, we can't push the negation in salva veritate, you know, keeping the relevant truth value. The same, actually, the all falsa says with temporal operators. We can't push in salva veritate, our negations or things like this. So, you know, we're not wandering around wildly contradicting ourselves. The only time that it's going to be true now that you will do something later is if it's presently necessitated. You know, there's something about present facts making it true. If it's not presently necessitated, if it is a real true future contingent proposition, then it's going to be false. One of the major sorts of objections that come to this view is to say, well, isn't this view just epistemically a huge problem at this point? At least if we think that bivalence doesn't hold, it's one thing to shrug if you think about whether or not you're going to have dinner with your friends. It's another to say, I think it's false that I will have dinner with them. And then I get on the subway and go to... Hey, how's it going? Yeah. I've been looking forward to this. There's something that seems initially a bit odd about this. Part of what the all falsist does is try to take the bite out of that. And myself and other people have argued that, well, bivalence denial doesn't look obviously better in terms of these kinds of predictive elements of things. And I actually think the key is to notice that if something is true on this view, it's going to always be true. If like once it's true, it's always going to be true. But if something is false, that doesn't mean it's always going to be false. Why? Because it's, you know, sometimes reality is unsettled. It's just, you know, the ultimate determiner is going to wait to see what we ourselves actually do. So the central claim that I think the presentist and others should deny is, you know, if something is now true, it's always been the case that it's true. Once we deny this, we can start denying things like, you know, if something is presently false, it's always going to be false. Well, we got to look at what kind of fact that is. Is it a mathematical fact? Okay, sure. Is it a future contingent of what, you know, we will do? Well, no, that seems very changeable depending on what we will actually do. We've just got to wait and see what we're actually going to be doing here. So it really, all of it depends on what's making something true or accounting for the truth of something. Where are those grounds? Those are three very different things to try to get at the same general concept here for as metaphysically robust or hands-off as you want to be about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much, Amy. This has been awesome. It's been a lot of fun talking. If listeners want to read some of your stuff and find you online, where can they go to follow your work?
Thanks so much for having me. They can go to my website. That is amyseymour.com.
Perfect.
Yeah. Thanks again. In our next episode, we will discuss a position called Molinism, and our guest will be William Lane Craig, visiting scholar of philosophy at Talbot School of Theology and professor of philosophy at Houston Baptist University.